Thank you, Caroline. Thank you, Marnie. I hope you can see and hear me well. I'm so happy to be here. Before we got into the technical glitch, I was just reading a bit on the chat, and seeing all of you saying hi from here and there, and many people I know. And so I had tears come up in my eyes because I was so happy that we were gathered all through these miles and time zones. And I was like, no, don't cry, Pascal. No, it's not the right time to start crying. Yes, so we're here to practice together for maybe 25 minutes or so, and then I'll share some ideas, and then we'll be able to do a Q&A. And today the Q&A will take the form of the written form because of the difficulties we're facing. I think we're gonna try to keep it simple with the videos and everything, and so you'll be able to ask your questions in the question box, but not now, not while we're sitting in meditation or practicing meditation. At the end, after the talk, if it works for you. Okay, so I'm so happy to be here with Sangha Live for the first time, and I'll be back mid-May, I think, to offer a course, a 4-week course that we're working on right now. So I'm really in the Sangha Live world right now. Great. So Marnie, thank you for taking care of the chat box. I won't be looking until we get to the Q&A because it's too much stimulation for moi. Okay. So yes, let's practice together. So please find a comfortable posture for yourself, and you might be already in that posture. And it means you could be sitting like I am, with this mixture of relaxation and wakefulness. This is a beautiful mix that we're developing in this practice of surrendering, maybe in relaxation, in care, in listening, and this aliveness that is there also. We're not just relaxing, we're relaxing, quieting down, and we're awake. And that can be done sitting, of course, but it could be done standing or lying down, like I'm sure a few of you are very comfy in maybe the bed or the sofa, and some of us on a cushion, bench, chair. And you could be, of course, standing. And very important, maybe as we get into this, that we don't try to produce something. We're not there to achieve anything. We're just creating some connection with the living world, the world of the body, or with the environment, and of course with the heart. And so you could do this the eyes closed, you could do this the eyes open, you could turn away the screen, maybe, to just hear my voice if you want to hear it. Or maybe just lower the gaze. Or if, like me, you're sitting close to a window, you could practice presence with connection with sky or a tree or space or whatever you see in front of you. So see, eyes closed, half closed, open. Yeah, just landing in this body, if it feels right, in this environment. That's what I like to do when I practice these days, see if it's similar for you, or if you want to play with this, but I like to get kind of attuned or in contact with the environment as I start my meditation. And so just discover, maybe you know, that there is a body sitting on something on earth here. So discovering the environment through the points of contact with the ground, chair, cushion, pillow. Yes, we are living beings in relationship with Earth. And in relationship with air as we breathe here. Air comes in and out. So many ways we're in relationship with the environment through our sensitivity to temperature. So allow yourself to feel that, the warmth or the coolness, or you might not be experiencing just now extreme cold or warmth. You're very sensitive to that. And we're sensitive to light, depending on where you are at this time of the day, which room. Some light or darkness. It's like this right now, in this environment. And of course, there are the sounds or the silence or the room tone here. Allowing the sounds or the silence to be experienced lucidly, consciously. So it's like this in this room now, the space. The light, the sounds, or silence. The temperature. And the gravity. This body is alive in an environment. And we're discovering this body, this sensitive, living body. It's here now. It's happening now. There's breathing. There's pressing on earth in some way. Body has its own coolness or warmth. And maybe we can become aware of this in some areas. Maybe it stands out. Or not. This body sensitive to sounds, to its own movements, Let's see if we can stay here in this environment, alive, awake, conscious. Can we stay here in this environment, in this body? Just listening or feeling. Experiencing life as it's happening. When we would often depart in thoughts or considerations of all kinds, is it possible to just stay here? Stay here. With this light, with this breath. With this body resting where it rests. And as we stay here in this environment, in this body, we discover the familiar or rediscover what it is to be alive, to be sensitive as it's happening. We discover what it's like to be attentive, attuned to what's happening here, awake. Being conscious, such a strange thing. Such a strange thing to be sensitive. It's happening now. And of course, as we're here with silence or with body breathing, we discover the state of the meditator, the scatteredness, the agitation, or the quietness, maybe. The state of our mind or heart is being revealed, maybe. Sometimes there's heaviness there, sometimes lightness, sometimes neither in one nor the other. Just enough energy to be in contact with something happening now. Just enough energy to experience something. The breath, the sounds, the ache. Or how it feels to be attentive. And sometimes it has a lot to say in there, many thoughts. And sometimes it has very little to say in there. Just taking it in, listening, receptive. It's okay. Sometimes it has a lot to say, sometimes not so much. Sometimes the mind is obsessed, occupied, under occupation, preoccupied, and sometimes available, open, quiet or curious. As we sit here with the sounds, the silence, the breath, we notice without judgment the state of this mind. We discover human nature, what it's like to be embodied as it pulls and pushes, expands and contracts, moves, as there is rigidity or fluidity. We discover embodiment, materiality. And we discover also human nature through the inner life, where it also sometimes pushes and pulls, a wave of agitation or frustration, a lake, quiet lake of calm, a rush of thinking. Nothing personal, just nature. Nature happening in the body, in the heart. nothing personal, nothing perfect, nothing permanent. Just life, dynamic, changing, air coming in, coming out. Sometimes attention, sometimes distractions. Natural. And for the last minute here, if your eyes are closed, I'd like to invite you to open them. Let the light come in. See if it's possible to be in meditation with eyes open as you look, maybe even look around. The eyes contacting colors and forms and brightness or darkness. As you look around, is it possible to feel the body in its posture, breathing? Is it possible to be sensitive, to awake, to conscious of the inner state? As we're seeing, as the eyes are open, to be aware of the state of this being. Maybe slightly curious, attentive. Very useful for daily life where our eyes are often open. Can we feel? Be sensitive to the environment through skin, touch, warmth, coldness, touch with ground as the eyes are open. Body awareness. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. And if you want, please, please, if you want, keep this going. Keep this kind of faithfulness to the immediate experience. You know, yes, 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 you can hear me and everything I have to say, but is it possible? Or, you know, or if you want to, you know, stay... See if you can stay awake to, you know, the surroundings, the environment you're in, the quietness in the room or the urban life around. Stay aware of maybe body if it feels right. Yeah, so as you're hearing me, hearing ideas, images, you know, is it possible to stay in touch, faithful to body? Knowing we're here, knowing I'm here, alive, body breathing, sitting. See, if you want to play with this, you don't have to, of course. Could just be an interesting way to be here. Maybe I'm giving instructions to myself. Yeah, that's it. I'm inviting myself to be connected as I'm going to be sharing some ideas with you here. Let's see how it goes. So I wanted to talk about these five images. If you've spent any small amount of time with me, I think you've heard either all of these images or some of them, because they're my all-time favorite. And so these, so there's a sutta, the Fena Sutta, and you can look it up and you'll find it in Access to Insight, maybe, or other sites. There's different translation. Even I know there's a bunch of French speakers here, and you can find it also translated in French and probably in Spanish, other languages, Asian languages, I would bet, you know, is easy to find. And so I heard these maybe 25 years ago, I think on the first retreat that I sat, and to me, they carried insight into the, you know, into the images themselves. We say that inside vipassana, to understand deeply, to clarify, you know, our perception, to go from an erroneous perception of what reality is to a more clear and aligned, aligned to reality perception of it, you know, what we call insight, a deeper understanding of what's going on. How does it work? How does suffering get created? How does freedom or opening or the sure heart's release happens, you know? So insight into reality or the human heart or human nature happens through meditation. It's one of the very powerful ways to gain insight. It's a felt experience. It comes from a quality connection with what is happening. Instead of being in preconceived ideas about things, you know, or hopes or projections, you know, like we slow down as we just did now, and we develop a high quality contact connection with reality as it's unfolding. And then it reveals its secrets that are not hidden secrets. They're just hidden by our lack of attention, you know. So together as a community, we gather and we cultivate that liberating attention, that attention that will make things reveal their nature, phenomena reveal their nature, if I can say it like this. And another way to gain insights, and we see this in the text, you know, is the Buddha, you know, talking to folks, sometimes a little group like us, or mid-sized group like us, or a large, large group of people. And the Buddha, either through images or bringing up questions or lists, as you know, will highlight something, and suddenly something becomes more clear. Oh, like our wisdom was not very far. There was just a small little veil, and the veil is lifted, you know, and suddenly we're like, yes, that's true, you know. And so hearing, you know, teachings can be a powerful thing. In combination, they're really great. Reading a book about Dharma, or hearing teachings, and practicing meditation formally and informally, reflecting on the meaning. These are all ways to develop a deep understanding. And so I remember these images when they were presented. They had a strong impact on me. I think they brought a sense of great enthusiasm, I think, or like they heightened curiosity. Oh my God, I have to go see this for myself. Okay, let's get into it. They're all in this one discourse called the Fena Sutta, the Foam Sutta, Fena, P-H-E-N-A, Foam Sutta. And so the Buddha says, so I like to just imagine, you know, there's a group like us. Okay, it's a little different. There's the internet, you know. Back then, there was something else, you know. People being together by the fire or the river, or, in a, somebody's house or courtyard or in the park, you know. Anyway, they're all, you can imagine, sitting maybe in a circle together, and the Buddha saying, hey, think about the foam that is, let's say, going down a river or by the side of the ocean. If you've ever seen this, a little lump of foam, you know, and he's saying, like, if somebody was to really come close, it sounds like meditation, you know, come close to the lump of foam and observe it and really come really close and be interested by it. Not just like, oh, it's foam, you know. But just like, hey, hold on, what is this made of? Let me come closer and really take a good, quiet look, long look at it. The Buddha says it would become really obvious to this person that it's made of nothing. It's empty at its core. You know, it's many, many, many little bubbles, you know, and it changes shape with every new wave, you know, the form, the foam, you know, either elongates or, you know, scratches and divides in many little lumps. And, you know, anybody would look at foam by the ocean would see how dynamic it is, how changing it is, and how empty at the core, without substance, yeah. Unsubstantial it is, you know, unstable, unreliable, you know, it's not solid, it's not how it looks maybe to be from, you know, when you look just a short glance, you know, oh, there's a lump of foam, you know, it's a thing, permanent thing. But if you blow on it, if you're in contact with it, you'll see, you know, there's nothing to it. And the Buddha says this, used this image of the foam to talk about the body. And I remember, maybe I heard this, it was already a few days within the retreat, a few days of actually practice. And it seemed to me so insightful that the Buddha could see through what I tend to think of the body as something solid, permanent. It's my body. I've been in it for a few decades now. But the Buddha saying, no, Pascal, that's what I'm hearing. Like, tune in, become really aware. You'll notice. If you close your eyes, for example, you'll notice that what you call a hand is a field, a very alive field of what? Warmth or coolness or space or tingling, you know? And that's what I've experienced in the development of practice, is that anything that seemed solid with a closer look shows its dynamic nature. Even like the hardness, like, for example, now, maybe you too, but I've certainly been sitting here for an hour. And so there's a hardness to it. But when I tune into this hardness, it's dynamic. It's alive. Like, it keeps giving. It keeps pressing. There's something very dynamic about it, even if it doesn't change or just increases in hardness with every few minutes. There's something about it. And also, if I stay curious, what I will notice, or that I have noticed many times before, is that, wow, suddenly it's completely gone. I'm just, the body's something else. Suddenly it's something in movement. It's something that is crossing another room. This hardness, as I feel it so clearly right now on my butt, is something so impermanent. And I could make a big case out of it, you know. Oh my God, my butt, you know. And really, it's something so ephemeral and almost dreamlike. And so that's the first image, the Buddha wanting us to become aware of this. And also, when he uses the term empty or void, without substance, you know, what he's pointing to. And then he'll say this, he'll say, what you see in the foam is what you see in the body. And anybody would look closely at the body would discover that it's changing. And there's nothing absolutely me or mine or I at the very core of it. In a conventional way, yes, it's my body. I have to take care of it. But on a very deep, kind of more absolute investigation here, we discovered that this hardness is the earth element. There's nothing that personal or inherently me about it is just a sensation that will be transformed in a few minutes. This can be so liberating. Oh, it can help release some of the identification with body. And, you know, these days I talk, I bring this back often because it comes back to mind. Annie Nugent, dear teacher, during the long retreat, sometimes at the Insight Meditation Society, sitting for months, you know, and at some point towards the second part of the retreat, it gets really quiet because everything's been said, you know, so there's no less instructions, less talks, you know, and we'll be sitting 12, practicing meditation 12, 14 hours a day for many days. And I remember sometimes out of the silence, you know, she would turn on the microphone in the hall with 100 people like us, you know, sitting, practicing. And she would just say, lump of earth. And I thought this was so mind-blowing because, you know, I was sitting there thinking, this is me, you know, and thinking me later. And when I get out of this retreat, I'm not going to be any further along. You know, I'm losing my time here. Why am I here? You know, and all about moi, 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 moi. And then she's like, little lump of earth. And then there was this kind of insight in that moment through these words and this image of, oh, it's just a little lump sitting here, like resting here. And I create a whole world around this Pascal, you know, and Pascal's unworthiness of Pascal, you know. And what's happening here? There's just earth resting on earth. The second image that the Buddha used is the image of the bubble. And he uses this to talk about feeling tone, that, what's the word I hear sometimes in English? Valence of pleasure and displeasure that comes with anything we experience. So this is, you know, basic stuff of life. When we hear something, taste something, smell something, see something, think of something, feel something in the body, it's either pleasurable, unpleasant, or maybe neither one or the other. And there's a big spectrum around this, as you know. And this is very central to our lives because our opinions are built around this. If I'm uncomfortable with something, it shouldn't happen, you know. And if something is pleasurable, I tend to get a little hooked, want more of it, fear losing it, you know. And the Buddha, to help us in our investigation of this pleasure, displeasure, these that appear with things heard, said, tasted, sorry, or any, you know, felt in the body or situations. So that night, maybe around the fire or wherever he was with these people, he says, hey, think in summer. And I like how, no, in the fall. And I like how he calls our imagination with invoking the seasons, you know. He's like, think of the fall when there's rain, you know, and the rain drops fall into small puddles. And when a raindrop falls, it makes little tiny, very minute little bubbles. And they burst almost automatically, little bubbles at the surface of the puddle of water. And I don't know if you can see this or imagine bubble in, you know, sparkling water or champagne, you know, small little bubble, they surface and boop, blow up. And the Buddha says, bubbles are experiences of pleasure and displeasure that we feel in the body, in the mouth, in the mind, in the heart, you know, in our relationships, you know, discomfort, comfort. All these are very, very unstable, changing. And in the same way that somebody would look at these little bubbles in the fall, you know, when the raindrops fall, and would see that the bubble lasts only a moment, that they can't be owned, that they're extremely ephemeral and conditional. You know, it takes the right conditions for them to come to be, and they don't last. And in the same way, anybody who would pay that much attention, the same kind of attention to feeling tone, really tracking their appearance and disappearance, their presence, their absence, would surely notice how unreliable these things are and how we tend, many of us, to kind of put all our eggs in the same basket, you know, to really invest in pleasurable, comfortable, you know, pleasure here being related to new in some cases. Oh, new means pleasurable, stimulating, you know, or sometimes pleasurable means the same, you know, don't change this. Comfortable for me means the same, you know, and now we get attached and clinging to this as, you know, thinking we can stabilize this. You know, when I get this, this is going to be comfortable and it will feel safe and it will be comfortable and pleasurable. And, you know, it could be anything, a status, you know, like how somebody else sees, oh, I'd like this person to see me in this way. It would be so pleasant if they saw me as worthy or great or beautiful or whatever, you know, and how stable is that? How conditional is that? How reliable or not is that? And so the Buddha, using the image of the bubble, is inviting us to become aware, to become intrigued by the, changing, unstable nature of pleasure, displeasure. So it's a different way to be in relationship with pleasure and displeasure, knowing that the very evanescent, is that the word? I'm not sure. Changing, liable to the conditions, you know. And there's a tremendous amount of freedom possible in not being so hooked into aligning the ducks, you know, or putting all the eggs in the same basket and in some ground, maybe some peace or balance of mind, and knowing that there will be these winds, you know, of pleasure and displeasure that will come, and that to a great extent, uncontrollable. You know, we can't control what somebody else will say to us or about us, you know, and to find deep peace into this unstable nature and the incapacity to actually own, like, let me make this pleasure mine and make it stay. No, because the same thing that I get access to that might have been pleasurable in the past might not be pleasurable this time, you know, like, oh, it doesn't feel as great as it did the last time, you know, or it felt great at the beginning, now I'm over it, you know. Wow, it's so, it escapes us, you know, we can't stabilize that. Okay, let's go to another image, the mirage. The Buddha, such gratitude for the Buddha and everyone who followed in, you know, in all the Asian cultures, you know, that kept these teachings alive. And so these images and so many more teachings we can gain access to and keep alive also ourselves, you know, for future generations. So the mirage. So the Buddha says, evoking seasons again, think at that, you know, at the highest point of the summer, of the heat of the summer, maybe towards the end of the summer, when the heat has gathered and collected, you know, and you look somewhere, you know, I don't know if he was looking at the Buddha at the paved road, asphalt or tarmac or something else, you know, but in the desert, maybe in a vast expanse of land, and how you can sometimes see a mirage, you know, like water in the distance. How it's also in its nature without substance, you know, there's nothing, it's empty, it's void of something core-like, it's just conditional. The conditions are such that the eye is perceiving, you know, an oasis or water over there. But when we get there, it's different. It's not that. And the Buddha says, well, if somebody was to study the nature of mirages, you know, of a mirage, this person surely would discover the empty nature of it, you know, how unreliable it is, changing, conditional, ephemeral. And so somebody who would stop, maybe take time to study this mind, you know, this mind and body, this mind, body, and its projections or perception, it would discover, you know, mirage-like nature, the mirage-like nature of our perceptions, how things appears, how something appears to me. It appears, it's an appearance, you know. And so the Buddha with this image is trying to clarify the nature of perception and inviting us to study this, to not be fooled by, not be duped by how things appear, but to look deeply, to bring sati, this kind of amazing awareness that can help reveal the nature of things, you know. And so how I appear to myself, like, oh, I'm so it, you know, or I'm so worthless, you know. Oh, it appears like this. It appears like this. Maybe that's mirage-like. Maybe that's not the whole truth. Somebody else, the future, how the future appears, how the past appears, how something solid appears, something appears solid and maybe is not. You know, so the Buddha was inviting us to become really aware of the changing nature of our perceptions. And oh, if we had more time, but we don't, I would get into, you know, and maybe I will in May when I do the course. Yeah, I will. We'll have the time to do this. You know, going from wrong perceptions to, you know, liberating and wise, right perceptions. And the classic things in there is, you know, perceiving solidity in things that are not by nature solid. You know, nothing is that solid that it can't, that it will stay the same, you know, or permanence or solidity or satisfaction. Oh, la, 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 la. Some of us, maybe not you, but many of us, we tend to project or perceive in things satisfaction. I can see this tendency in me is incredibly strong. You know, I'll see just like barely see something from a distance and I'll often like plaqué, it's a French word here, but the put on it, you know, like satisfaction. Oh my God, it looks great. You know, I'll see something for a second and desire like kicks in, you know, like it squeezes itself in the perception, you know. And suddenly I'm like, oh, no, not so, you know. So mirage perception. And it's good when we're aware of this. Suddenly something appears a certain way and we're like, oh, it appears like this. That's how I talk to myself. Oh, Pascal, it appears like this. It appears like it's not going to work, you know. Let's see. And let's not conclude at least or solidify that perception, you know. This appears like desirable situation. Let's see, you know. Then, oh, that next image. These are all deserving of a talk each, but that's not going to happen today. We're moving through. So the banana tree trunk, I think my all-time favorite, I have to say. And so this one, the Buddha has a whole story again, and he's saying, you know, imagine somebody would want really like reliable, strong wood to build something, maybe a shelter, a refuge, you know, and or some project anyway they have. They want to something solid, hardwood or heartwood, I think we say in English. And so they would go to the forest looking for the best tree, you know, to get the best wood for their project, to build something very, you know, reliable. And so they see this banana tree or plantain tree, and then they think, oh my good Lord, I don't know if that's exactly their thoughts, but something similar to this, you know. And they think, wow, look at these fruits, huge leaves, huge flower maybe. That's gotta give, this is gonna give really good wood. And so this person with their axe, they start axing the banana tree, and they find at its core just fiber. It's a kind of a grass-like herb, you know, grass, I think you say in English. There's nothing, there's no hardwood, heartwood in there. Nothing you can rely on. When the banana tree bears its fruit, it falls on the ground. And so, voila, this is the Buddha saying anybody would look at put the axe or peel the layers of layers by layers, the banana tree trunk would discover that there's nothing solid in there when it's as born, given its fruit, it falls on the ground and is composted. You know, there's nothing, it's empty at its core. There's no hardwood that you can count on. And the Buddha said, if somebody was to study a banana tree, they would find this for sure. They would clarify their, you know, assumptions or perceptions around this. So would, it's the same thing as a banana tree. If somebody was to sit and really study the mind and notice everything it comes up with, the mental formations. So he uses that image to talk about the mental formations, the intentions, the stories that are told inside, you know, the all these things that happens in the mind, you know. The Buddha says in the same way, they would find nothing at the core of it, something being constructed and falling apart, you know, and nothing that you can count on, especially nothing that you could count on as being me, or I, or core I, just kind of storytelling, fiction. So you're sitting here in meditation and, oh my God, if this person was to say this to me, then I would answer this, then they would say that, and then what would I say? What would I say? You know, oh, I would say this, you know. You create a kind of a banana production like this, you know. And with the feelings, you know, it's not just a story being told or images. It comes with, you know, the pulsating heart, the squeezed belly, you know, the throat, paralyzed, you know, and all the fear and all this. And suddenly if we stay long enough on the cushion or if we stay long enough in life, we'll see like, oh, disappeared. You know, it was a construction of the mind, you know. And, you know, these things we cling or identify or get fused as I or mine. This is core me. I'm not the body, Pascal. I'm not the pleasure, the displeasure, but I'm, you know, the one that thinks in there. Or maybe you've clarified this. Maybe you think, no, I know thoughts. You know, they're not exactly me or mine. You know, they just come from conditions, you know, from emotions, from culture, from family, old messages, you know, worry has a lot to say, you know, it's not me, but the witness, you know, or the one who intend, you know, to intend, the one who decides to stand up or speak, this is me, you know. And the Buddha says, no, even the intention is like a banana tree. It bears its fruits and collapses, you know. Intentions are ephemeral. They come and go. Remember the intention you had to not go to school or quit this or do that. You know, these intentions arose due to conditions and they passed. You know, we can't even cling to this as I or mine. Of course, there's a responsibility, you know, about the intentions being put out, because some are going to be harmful for self and others and some are going to be healing or helpful, supportive. There's a sense of responsibility possible, but still, it's not me exactly. It's not an enduring me that keeps producing intentions, you know. Well, this is what the teaching says. We have to go see for ourselves. And the last image before we go to a few maybe questions about this. Wow, this is so rich. There's so much stuff in there. The last image is the magic trick. So the Buddha says, imagine. So he's using these images, not just for entertainment. He's using these images to, I think, to inspire, ignite curiosity, bring energy to practice so we can go and see for ourselves. Wow. What a trip. Is that true that it's similar to a magic trick? And so the Buddha says a magic trick. Imagine somebody was really attentive and was seeing a magic trick being performed maybe many times. And over time would discover that, see through the veil, through the trick, you know, see that it's empty. It's not true. You know, it's just a, you know, agility of the fingers or some visual play, you know, that it seems like the rabbit is coming out of the hat, you know, or, and the person would understand this is a trick. This, there's nothing to it. It's unsubstantial. It's empty in its core, you know. The Buddha says in the same way, if somebody, it's open, whoever wants to, could, can, you know, people have done it. It's possible to do it. Maybe we're doing it. Maybe you're doing it. It's worth doing. If somebody was fooled by a magic trick and was to pay real good attention, they might be able to see how it's made up, you know, how it's not how it appears to be. And in the same way, somebody who wants to could, studying consciousness, this event or experience of being conscious, could discover that it's exactly like a magic trick. It creates a sense of I am the observer, I am the witness, I am the one behind the eyes to whom everything is happening, you know. And the Buddha said, seems to say, you know, if somebody was to look at this very closely, he would discover that there's nothing substantial, nothing at the core of what we call consciousness that is I, mine, in an absolute way, in the way that I conceive it or perceive it or think of it or even sense it, you know, because this teaching, especially this last one, can be quite counterintuitive, because I really have a sense that I am there, in there at least, you know, if I'm not exactly this, I'm in there, you know. And the Buddha says it's worth, you know, checking this out with high quality awareness to maybe discover that at the core of this, there's just moments of consciousness. The consciousness of a sound as the sound appears and disappears, the consciousness of a sensation or a painful sensation, if that's present, while it's there, and then this consciousness disappears. There's been so many moments of consciousness since we've been born. And we think it's me, the solid, permanent consciousness there. And the Buddha seemed to be saying, check it out with good quality awareness. You might discover that these things just appear and disappears, and the compactness of these moments stick together, you know, creates a little bit like a pearls will create a necklace, you know, like these moments of consciousness, we made them me. But the little person running around on their fours, you know, the child that we were, you know, all these moments of consciousness of a good taste, a pain, you know, a painful sensation, all these have arisen and disappeared. That's it, the five images. What do you say? What do you think? Let's take a moment to let these pass. Foam, bubbles, mirage, banana tree trunk, magic show. Wow, such a different reality than the solid one happening to me that we are perceiving and conceiving most of the time, many of us. Huh? Let's go see. I see two questions here. Okay, as Buddhist, we believe in anatta, not self, no self, and emptiness. So what is it or who is it that takes rebirth? If there is no self and no thing, this is the classic question. Thank you, Claire. It's never not been asked at the Q&A or in a retreat, or it's a very, very classic question. Of course, you know, it's a really good question, you know. So how to respond to this? Who is being reborn? Yeah, and I don't know if you've heard, many of you maybe have heard the response from a very revered Tibetan teacher, and the response was deep and funny. The response was, "Who gets reborn? It's not you gets reborn. It's your neurosis. It's the confusion that gets reborn, because there would be this kind of identification, appropriation of, you know, either body or emotions or thoughts or these experiences of pleasure, displeasure, or this event of consciousness is taken so personal. There's a belief in it. With this clinging comes a wanting to keep. That's what grasping is. You know, this is me. I grasp it as me, and I fear the disappearance of it. I want it to continue. And that desire, that confusion, that clinging is so strong that at the, it says that at the death of the body, of the physical body, this neurosis, this wanting to be, this wanting to become, to be, to exist, to, this identification is so strong that it will manage to be reborn. And so that's the confusion that is reborn. And so the practice of meditation is to bring in wisdom, more and more, cultivate wisdom so we see clearly. And so when we see clearly, there's a letting go. When we see the empty nature, the unsatisfactory nature, the unreliable, unstable nature, the not-self nature, the clinging releases. There's less of a need to be seen, exist in this way, have that next experience, not die, not be anymore. And so this is released at some point, and there's no more birth. And another image that could be useful is if you think of a candle with a flame here. There's a candle burning, and you bring another candle. This one is not burning, and you bring the flame to this one here. So when you do this passation, or you hear this passage of the flame, is it the same candle? Is it the same flame here? No, you could say this is very independent. It's its own thing. But there was a causality. There was a, which is really important, as you know, in the Buddhist teaching, cause and effect. And so there's something that caused this to happen. But this is not the same candle. It's not the same wax. It could be a different color made somewhere else. You know, and the flame, it's its own flame. It's not that flame. That flame is still here in a way, you know. And so that's a way, maybe through an image, to see some of this. So that maybe is the beginning of some answers here. And here, another one. Thank you for your teaching, Pascal. They belong to the Buddha and all those who passed them down. Yeah, I'm happy though to be sharing them. Could you please say more about the role of the much longer retreats you talked about? What their role in the context of a lifetime's practice? Maybe when and how to approach them, what they bring to one's practice, and what one loses if one doesn't make time and space for these? Many thanks. Hey, Henry. That's a delicate subject because, you know, I wouldn't make them an absolute need or, you know, because things are conditional, you know. So it takes many conditions to come together for a long retreat to happen. And it takes the interest of a person, you know. It takes a lot of outside conditions, maybe the financial conditions, although there's possibility to play with this for sure. It needs the physical condition. I might want to, but it might not be possible due to some physical conditions at some point in my life. Maybe the situations around me, family, work, etc. And there would need to be interest, you know, which I can totally imagine that the interest never arises in somebody. Actually, it does. Most of the world population want to think or have the desire to experience this. Maybe I can talk for me a little bit here and say, very honestly, for me, they've been extremely important. Anything that I'm talking about, or much of what I'm talking about when I'm sharing as a teacher, comes from insights I got on these long retreats. So they've been for me very, very important and essential and nourishing. And I think why? Because it's a laboratory. It's still life. Everything happens, but there's something that can be very supportive, and it might not be also. I can imagine this being possible too. For me, it was supportive. And so somebody's cooking for you. You're in the woods with other people. And so there's the power of the Sangha, because people put a lot of hours in their practice. You know, they go back to the sitting, the meditation hall. And so alone, it was harder for me at that time. And I think it still is to do this alone. Or so with the Sangha, with the community, it's much more powerful. And for me also, I was receiving a talk every night, let's say for the first couple of months, if I was sitting at 3 months for sure, maybe more. So that's a lot of information on the Dharma. So it helped me create the map, understand the map of the terrain, you know, or the path, if you see it in this way, you know, what is the path? So a lot of information. I actually like the retreats and the long retreats, because there's three levels of understanding that are welcome and essential for understanding and development. One is information. So when you get instructions and talks, you get information and understanding. You gain understanding. Then there's so much hours that there's time to reflect. So it means I heard something. I'm thinking about it. What does it mean for me? This thing about nothing is really mine. Has this been proven true in my life? You know, so I reflect on this with thoughts and images, memory, creative thinking, you know. So this is the second kind of understanding, a way to gain understanding. And the third one is vipassana. It's sati, to mindfulness, to experience. So it's not thinking about, it's not reading information, it's not thinking about, is experiencing. And you imagine on a 3-month retreat how many hours of this you'll gain. And so there's the possibility to create a little bit of a lab here where there's a lot of silence, there's nature, you know, the social level is kept very minimally because we don't talk to each other. We still live together, you know, but it's a very protective space dedicated for practice. So I don't have to go earn money while I'm there. I don't have to take care of anybody else. I'm just here supported to be able to study the mind. And so it's very useful. So what I would say is, I think it's a good idea, if you're so inclined to sit a little longer than what you've done. If you've done a weekend, or never done a weekend, you do one, then you do a week, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. There's retreats that are 6 weeks. And so, or maybe the circumstances are right and you're like, whoa, there's an opening, there's the finances are possible, and I could do a full 3 months. For me, after I sat a week, you know, there was this in me that was like, I heard about it 3 months and I was like, I can't believe this is possible. I have to. It was enthusiasm. It was not dread. That's an important factor, you know. So for me, there was like, I can't believe this. I'm doing this for sure. You know, I want to try this. What would come up in 3 months after doing this just for a week? And so, yeah, very useful, because of the level of concentration, I think, that you can gain. The mind can settle over a few days, and maybe not, because, you know, all kinds of things are unreliable. You know, all kinds of things can happen in the mind, but it happens that minds, you know, get very quiet and then laser-like. You know, the mind is less scattered, more gathered. So when it is in contact with the phenomena, it stays with it. It can see it arise and pass. It can see the mind constructions behind, you know, what I make of this thing, you know, and what it is really. Okay, that's my try on that. And here, maybe the last one, we'll see. I've been worrying a lot about aging and my eventual death. Can you speak about impermanence in relation to aging in a way that's not depressing? Can I do that? Well, I don't know. I'm curious about death. I'm, you know, maybe I'll regret it when I get close to it, but it's so part of life, you know, like it seems like nobody has ever not died. So for me, it makes me a little bit like a 3-month retreat. You know, there's some part of me is like, wow, I wonder how it's going to be in the body, in the mind. Is it going to be progressive or sudden? You know, what will the mind do? Will it be able to take it on? And, you know, practicing now for me is preparing for that moment that I'd really like to be there in a, you know, in a calm way, maybe in a balanced way. I don't know if it's going to be possible. I don't know what my mind will come up with at that moment. But, and also because we can include aging in this, you know, like folks are aging, you know, everybody, we're all aging, you know, how can that be met with some kind of grace or humor or compassion? You know, there's an alchemy there that is interesting to me. Like, how can something that might be experienced as difficult in different parts of it, how can it, instead of lead to depression and discouragement, and how could it lead to joy, to gratitude, to curiosity, to great tenderness, to acceptance, to letting go? I think there's tremendous potential and I think everyday situation are possible preparation for this. You know, when my mind clings to an opinion or an idea of how it should be, and, you know, like, wow, what am I going to do at the time of death? You know, I'm going to have to let go of everything. I better start practicing now with this, not getting all uptight and bogged down and freaked out by everything, you know. So these are some of the things that come to mind. Thank you so much for asking. Wow, we're coming very close to the end. Maybe it's time to stop here. Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for being there, for keeping this community alive and vibrant, as I see, you know. And thank you for the Dana that you can access. I can see it myself, this little button there. It keeps the teachings alive in this community alive, this teacher alive, you know, because this teacher, as many of the teachers who come here, live on this, on your generosity, and they, you know, makes it possible also for us to be generous and support others in their practice. But also the generosity is bigger than this. It keeps a heritage alive between people in groups and in cultures, you know, and God knows others will need this to be alive and accessible. And so the donations are totally linked to this, you know, because they make such offering possible, you know. And you know that the teachers, they do go where they're supported. That's, you know, it was true 2600 years ago. You know, if a village was not supportive of the monks, nuns, you know, practicing in the woods, they would move. They would go somewhere where they were supported, because it's essential to keep being alive and practicing and sharing. And so this is really real. So there's joy possible in the generosity, and there's also a sense of responsibility, I think, that is also beautiful, maybe uncomfortable, but beautiful anyhow. I really look forward to seeing you wherever I see you next. And yes, in May, I'll be doing something with Sangha Live, a 4 weeks class, and we'll be able to exchange really live that time. So I hope you'll be there. Bring your friends. Best to you.